We were in the book of Ezra last week. We want to get back to that, finish it up this evening. We'll start in chapter 6. Ezra chapter 6. Remember, we had left off where the commandment had been given for them to stop building the city of Jerusalem again, back in chapter 4. And then in chapter 5, some of the prophets, Haggai and Zechariah in particular, began to get on to the people and tell them they needed to get back to building. And so it was that during the reign of Darius, the people began to build again. And they sent a letter to Darius, speaking to him, telling him that they had been told to rebuild this city, told him to check the records, and that he would find that it was true that they had been authorized to rebuild Jerusalem. Now it comes chapter 6 then. Darius makes a decree and writes to the governor that is on the other side of the river, in other words, the governor that's in the area of Judea where Jerusalem is being built. And this is what he says to that governor, verse 7 and 8. Let the work of this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God in his place. Moreover, I make a decree what ye shall do to the elders of these Jews for the building of this house of God, that of the king's goods, even of the tribute beyond the river, forthwith expenses be given unto these men, that they be not hindered. So Darius was a good king, and at least good for the Jews. He got things going again, even paying them for building the temples, giving them the supplies they needed, and taking those expenses out of the tribute or out of the taxes for them to do that. And of course, in our country today, the government doesn't support the building of religious institutions like that. But at that time, they certainly did. And that was what Darius had done. He gave money from the king's good, even of the taxes or the tribute, so that the expenses would be taken out of that, so that they wouldn't be hindered. So again, the temple is being built as it should be. Then in chapter 7, Ezra finally arrives. First 6 chapters of the book, named after Ezra, he wasn't even there. He came on the scene late. Ezra came on the scene during the reign of Artaxerxes. Remember, we had King Xerxes earlier, and now we have King Artaxerxes. Sometimes it's difficult to keep the two straight, because sometimes Xerxes is even referred to as Artaxerxes. It makes it difficult sometimes to keep straight which one which. You have to sometimes take a close look at the order of things, as in this case. This is after Darius is governor, that Artaxerxes is governor, and Ezra comes to Jerusalem. Notice in verse 10, it tells about Ezra. For Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it, and to teach in Israel statutes and judgments. Ezra, we know, and we talked about last week, was a scribe. He was a teacher of the law. You know, when Jesus was on this earth, he had quite a few run-ins with the scribes and the teachers of the law. He condemned them for the way that they would strain at the gnat and swallow the camel, so to speak, and the way that they would twist the scriptures. And he told them on one occasion, search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and it is they which testify of me. And so he got on to those men because of the fact that here they were. They were supposed to be the teachers of the law. They were the scribes who wrote the copies of the Bible. And they had it. At that time, they only had the law and the prophets. They didn't have the New Testament letters, obviously. But what they had, they would make copies of it by hand. You know, they didn't have a printing press or a Xerox machine that they could just go run off copies. They had to write each copy out by hand. Quite a diligent task, quite a difficult task, and a very time-consuming task. But these individuals then who wrote those out were called scribes, and those who studied then, the teachers of the law, Ezra was both. Ezra was a scribe and a teacher of the law. Notice notice then here it says that he was also, in verse 11, a priest. Ezra the priest, the scribe, even a scribe of the words of the commandments of the Lord and of his statutes to Israel. And we saw then in verse 10 that he had set his heart to teach Israel the statutes and judgments. So he was a priest, a scribe, and a teacher of the law. He would have been certainly a very devout individual. Those at the time of Jesus even, they were very devout people. They were wrong. They were confused about the scriptures. They didn't understand them. They taught some of them wrong. But they were still very religious, very devout people. But Ezra was one of those people. He had prepared his heart. Now, we have a lot of times in the church today, people who are reading the Bible, quoting the Bible, even teaching the Bible, who have never prepared their hearts. And that's a sad situation. If you have people who, oh yes, they may be very knowledgeable about the words, and they may know all about the culture, and they may have studied the original languages of Hebrew and Greek and all of these things. But if they haven't prepared the heart, then all of their teaching is liable to be in the wrong direction. So all of their teaching is going to be based on the letter of the law and not the spirit of the law. They're not going to understand the reasons that God gave these things. They're not going to understand the depth of the love of God. Because they themselves, even though they've studied the words and they look at all the details, and there's a big movement in the colleges and universities of textual criticism where they critique everything and try to make sure, well, you know, is this the right word that was in? And we have lots of copies of different manuscripts of the Greek and the Hebrew and Aramaic, copies of these things, and so they'll compare them and say, okay, well, these 12 have this word, and this one over here has this other word in that spot. And so they make a big deal out of that. And sometimes they miss, in getting so wrapped up in that and so involved in that, they miss the idea. They miss the whole point that God was trying to get across and getting wrapped up in this detail of the study. That's not to say that it's wrong to study in detail. We need to, because sometimes the entire meaning of a passage does hinge on one word and the proper interpretation of that word. We've seen in the religious world today how a failure by the translators of the King James Version to actually translate the word baptizo and put immerse or immersion or immersed, whichever the proper term in different versions would have been, and actually put that in the English version and instead just make it baptized or baptism. And when they did that, look at the problems that it has caused down through the years. So certainly we know that one single word can be very important, not to belittle that in any way, but we have to realize the importance of having our heart prepared for the matter. We have to study God's Word with the proper mindset and the proper attitude of the heart. Our heart has to be prepared to listen to what God's Word has to say for us and to us. Then chapter 8, verses 21 and following, Ezra writes, "Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Ahava, that we might afflict ourselves before our God to seek of Him a right way for us and for our little ones and for all our substance. For I was ashamed to require of the king a band of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy in the way, because we had spoken unto the king, saying, The hand of our God is upon all them for good that seek Him. But His power and His wrath is against all them that forsake Him. So we fasted and besought our God for this, and He was entreated of us." Notice what Ezra says. They were about to start out on their journey, and there was going to be some difficulty in the process. They were afraid they were going to run into some people who didn't want Jerusalem to be rebuilt, who didn't want them to go, didn't want them to be involved in it. But he says, "I was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers to protect us." And notice why he says, because because we had already spoken to the king about how God was looking out for us. In essence, is what he said. He said, we had already spoken that the hand of our God is upon all them for good that seek him, but his power and wrath is against all them that forsake him. And so, can you imagine, you've told the king, well, king, you know, we need to go do this, and we're going to go do this, and God is all for those of us who want to worship him and follow him right, and he, his power is, and his wrath are against all of those people who are against him. And then, oh, but king, you know, there might be some bad people in the way. We need some soldiers to protect us. See, the king would say, well, you don't have a very powerful God, do you? If your God is there for you and against those that would try to stop you, then why would you need my soldiers? And so Ezra, instead of going to the king, he did what all who trust in God should do. He went to God and he proclaimed a fast, and they fasted and they prayed to God and asked him to give them a safe journey. And they did make that safe journey, and no one was harmed in the process. There were about 1,750 to 1,800 people who went up with Ezra back to Jerusalem during the reign of Artaxerxes, somewhere around that range. And so you would think that a group that size wouldn't really have a whole lot to worry about from bandits anyway, 1,800 people. But a lot of them may have been young people, the little ones too, so they wanted to be sure they were protected. So they prayed to God. And we see in that Ezra's leadership. Ezra didn't go off on this journey without first going to God about it. He didn't try to lead this people off into the unknown without first making sure that they had everything right with God. And then in chapter 9, Ezra runs upon another problem when he gets there. When he gets to the land of Israel, he finds that some of the Israelites had married people of the land, some of the Canaanites, and that they had not separated themselves as God had told them to, but they had intermarried with these people, and even some of them had children and sons and daughters by these wives they had taken from these people who worshiped foreign gods and idols. Verses 5 and 6, notice Ezra's prayer. It says, and at the evening sacrifice I arose up from my heaviness, and having rent my garment and my mantle, I fell upon my knees and spread out my hands unto the Lord my God, and said, O my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift up my face to thee, my God, for our iniquities are increased over our head, and our trespass is grown up unto the heavens. You ever feel that way? You ever feel like the sins that are in your life are just so big and so many that they've grown all the way up to heaven? Well, Ezra expressed that in regard to these people who had intermarried with the heathen. And he expressed that fear that God would again reject them. Remember, God had rejected the people because of their sinfulness, because of their refusal to separate themselves from the people of the land and to separate themselves from the practices of those people. And because of that sinfulness, he had taken them off into captivity. And so now here they are, they've come back to Jerusalem, and here are some who have married the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Ammonites and the Moabites and some of the Egyptians and the Amorites. And Ezra looks at that and thinks, how are these people going to be pure in worshiping God when they have defiled themselves in this way? So he prays to God on behalf of that. Then in chapter 10, we see what the prayer and, of course, the teaching as well that Ezra did from the law, what effect it had on the people. Verse 2 of chapter 10 says, and Shechaniah, the son of Jehiel, one of the sons of Elam, answered and said unto Ezra, we have trespassed against our God, and have taken strange wives of the people of the land. Yet now there is hope in Israel concerning this thing. Now for make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and such as are born of them according to the counsel of my Lord, and of those that tremble at the command of our God, and let it be done according to the law. We have to remember that the law of Moses was very different than the Christian law. Under the law of Moses, they were to separate themselves completely from those other people. The Israelite religion, the Hebrew religion, was not a religion of going out and converting others to it. Now, there were some who were converted. We know about Rahab. We know how Jesus talked about the fact that there were some proselytes, or in other words, converts to Judaism during his time. We read about the Ethiopian eunuch who had gone up to Jerusalem to worship. He was a Jew, but he was an Ethiopian, so he was a Jew by religion. So there were some, but that wasn't the primary thrust of the Jewish religion. The Christianity, that's the primary goal of the Christian religion, is to preach the gospel to all the world, to teach them, to convert them, to bring them to Christ. But that wasn't the way the old law worked at all. The old law's idea was, you are the nation of Israel, you keep yourself separate from all of them, and you keep yourselves pure. Don't try to go out and convert them. In fact, when they came into the land of Canaan, quite the opposite of trying to convert those people, they were supposed to wipe them off the face of the earth. They weren't out there to try to convert them. In that way, Judaism in those early years was very similar to the Muslim religion or the religion of Islam, and the idea of victory by the sword, not by the preaching and teaching of peace and of the gospel and good news. But we see these people's conviction. Imagine, if you will, the difficulty of such a decision to separate from yourself your wife or husband, your children that had been born to that spouse because that individual didn't share the same religion that you did. These people showed their devotion to God. Notice what he says, and of those that tremble at the commandment of our God, let it be done according to the law, he says in verse 3. That was the law. That was what the law taught, that they were not to have these foreign wives. So in order to be in accordance with that law, they had to put them away from themselves. We aren't asked to make that kind of decision very often. It's difficult, very stringent, abiding by the law. But even so, there are things as Christians that we are told to remove ourselves from, to abstain from, to stay away from, to get as far from as we can, to keep ourselves separate from, unspotted by the world, James tells us. To keep ourselves unspotted by the world. Even though it may not be that same thing that Ezra dealt with, there are still things in each of our lives that we need to put away from us. It may not be a husband or wife, and in some cases it actually is. Someone who's not scripturally married has a husband or wife they have to put away. That's because it's not right in God's eyes. But in many other cases, there are things that we have to put away in order to be pleasing to God under His new covenant. If you're here this evening and perhaps there's something in your life that you should have put away, but you didn't do that. Or perhaps you have been looking to the wrong place for support and for strength. Ezra went to God and asked God for protection. We need to be looking to God to provide our needs as well, rather than mankind, rather than government, rather than our own power or our own wealth, or whatever the case may be. If you're here and you have a need to respond to the invitation for any reason, we ask that you do so as we stand.